Welcome to the Naval Academy Museum's Warrior Writers Podcast. I am your host, Sal, from the blog Commander Salamander, and this 14-part series will take you decade by decade, starting with the 1870s, discussing the personalities, technologies, and events that helped shape today's U.S. Navy. This podcast coincides with the Naval Academy Museum's exhibit, Warrior Writers, the U.S. Naval Institute, open from September 10th, 2015, through January 31st, 2016. Our guest for each episode leading us through the decades will be first Naval Academy History Professor Emeritus and noted historian Craig Simons, who is awarded the Samuel Eliot Morison Prize for his novel Neptune, The Allied Invasion of Europe and the D-Day Landing, and is also author of the upcoming book, A Concise History of the U.S. Navy. Craig will be followed by the director of the Naval Academy Museum, Claude Barrabe. Craig, the arms race and battleship construction began in the first decade of the new century. How will that continue into the 1910s, and how did the USA compete relative to the other major powers?
Well, it did continue into the 1910s. In fact, it continued right up to and into World War I. I think you can make a pretty good case, in fact, that the naval arms race, particularly between Britain and Germany, was one of the contributing factors to the naval arms race, to the outbreak of the First World War. The alliance system is clearly part of that, the nervous tensions that had emerged in Europe in the years since the Franco-Prussian War, all of that is certainly a part of it. But the naval arms race, I think, was a critical element. And that, of course, when I say naval arms race, I'm talking particularly in terms of dreadnought battleships. These are the new battleships that had emerged in the first decade of the 20th century, the all-big-gun, oil-fired battleships that emerged after 1906, the dreadnought being the first of those. The United States does play a role, but it's a secondary one. We're not part of the European power balance. We're not part of the European run-up to war. We're going to get dragged into this. We know that. But the construction of battleships is not really, for the United States, a principal issue here. We do begin to build dreadnoughts. In fact, we could have built the first dreadnought with the USS Michigan and South Carolina that had actually been laid down in 1905. But Jackie Fisher, the British First Sea Lord, recognizing the emergence of this new kind of all-big-gun battleship and its importance, hastened the construction of the dreadnought so that it came out in 1906. The first American dreadnought is the USS Michigan, which is commissioned in 1910, and three more of them are commissioned later that same year, and two more in 1911. So we really have six of them by 1911. So we're in the middle of this emerging technological revolution of battleship technology in the second decade of the 20th century, even though we're not really part of that European power struggle.
And as the era of battleships sets the tone for this decade, we also start to see on the horizon the first stirrings of what will eventually become the battleship's replacement, and that's naval aviation. What were some of the first initial steps we saw in aviation this decade?
Well, of course, the airplane is brand new. The airplane itself is brand new, but it doesn't take long for Navy people to begin to assess what role it might play, if any, in naval combat as well. Seaplanes are among the first uses of naval aviation, land-based planes for coastal patrols and so on. But the idea of flying an airplane off of a ship and then maybe even landing an airplane on a ship, that comes fairly quickly, surprisingly. In fact, it's in 1910, the very first year of this decade we're discussing today, that Eugene Ely becomes the first pilot to fly off a ship. The Navy built a wooden platform on a cruiser, the USS Birmingham, and it's anchored. It's not even underway. You know, the thing about naval aviation as it grows to maturity is that carriers will have to turn into the wind to create relative wind across the flight deck so that the plane can get up. But here's an anchored ship with a wooden, temporary wooden flight deck built on the stern of it, just to see if this crazy pilot can in fact make this thing happen. In November 1910, he did. He flew an airplane, a biplane, obviously, off of the USS Birmingham. And only a couple of months later, early in 1911, he also lands on a temporary wooden platform built this time on the USS Pennsylvania. So he has demonstrated that it can be done, but clearly in 1910 and 1911, when this happens, it's perceived as a kind of stunt. Only a very few visionaries can see the day, not really very far away now, when dedicated aircraft carriers will carry dozens, scores, eventually as many as 100 airplanes into combat. Right now, we're in the very early moments of that. In fact, it's not really until middle to late summer 1911 that the Navy first contracts for an airplane, two of them, in fact, to Glenn Curtiss. So here are the first sort of straws in the wind. And had naval aviation not become one of the dominant characteristics of warfare in the 20th century, these would have been just little sideshows. We look back on them now to pick out that moment when naval aviation was born. What's going to happen now in the rest of this decade is that the onset of war in 1914, and I know we're going to talk about this as well, but the beginning of the First World War, that creates a lot of momentum, a lot of inertia for the development of naval aviation. The British will begin using seaplanes and eventually even carrier-based planes in the First World War before we're even a major belligerent. So war in this, as in most things, becomes an accelerator of new technology, and naval aviation gets a big boost from the outbreak of war.
And obviously the First World War dominates much of the Navy Marine Corps discussion of this decade. But there are other things going on around the world that we're involved in. What about some of the small wars and peacekeeping operations that the Navy and the Marine Corps team were involved in?
Yeah, that's great. That's true. We should not forget that, because peacekeeping and on distant station patrol had been the Navy's principal job for most of its history, certainly throughout the 19th century. These small squadrons stationed abroad, Africa, Asia, the Mediterranean, and elsewhere, looking out for American commercial interests in particular, but also kind of keeping the peace, or at least the peace as we would like it to emerge. And for much of the 1910s, it's in the Western Hemisphere, the Caribbean especially. Haiti, the Dominican Republic, Nicaragua, Central America generally, these are areas where Navy ships show up to make sure that the difficulties ashore, sometimes political squabbling, sometimes banditry, don't extend over in such a way as to threaten American commercial interests or political objectives. I suppose the most famous of the peacekeeping efforts, certainly the largest of all the peacekeeping efforts in this decade, is the landing the Navy and Marine Corps makes at Veracruz in Mexico. This came about because a virtual civil war is going on in Mexico. President, the Americans call him a dictator, Huerta, is confronting a revolution from dissatisfied Mexicans who want to overthrow him. Wilson, President Woodrow Wilson, is very sympathetic with the revolutionary elements in Mexico. So he's kind of looking for opportunities to embarrass or even depose Huerta. Huerta's indifferent control of his regime has led to banditry across the border into Texas, has led to what we call piratical operations off the Mexican coast. And so American naval forces have developed quite a squadron in the Gulf of Mexico, ostensibly to look out for American commercial interests, but also kind of to look for opportunities to embarrass the Huerta regime. And that opportunity emerges in 1914, just before the World War I breaks out, when a United States Navy boat crew is detained. It's not held very long, and they're soon after released, but Wilson sees in this an opportunity to demand his pound of flesh. He insists on a formal apology from the Mexican government, and that they must raise the American flag over the fortress at Veracruz and fire a 21-gun salute. In other words, he's trying to humiliate them. Huerta stalls. He asks for, what about a, well, we'll do that. We'll fire a salute if you'll fire a salute in return. Wilson says, absolutely not. That's not acceptable. And orders a landing, orders the occupation of the customs house in Veracruz. And that happens. The Navy puts ashore 500 Marines supported by 300 Blue Jackets. They take over the customs house. There's sporadic fighting. The Mexican Naval Academy is there, and the midshipmen at the Naval Academy resist this. They lose over 100 killed of these young men. Eventually, an Army force arrives, a U.S. Army force arrives, to support the landing force, and we essentially occupy the city of Veracruz. One of the little side notes to this, kind of interesting, the Medal of Honor, which had been created during the Civil War, to recognize extraordinary accomplishments, of course, feats of bravery in particular, by American servicemen. For whatever reason, 55 Medals of Honor were issued for this operation, the occupation of Veracruz. It embarrassed a lot of people who said that it was it demeaned the value of the Medal of Honor. One commentator said they gave them away like Cracker Jack toys. But in any case, a number of people who then carried Medals of Honor into the war earned them, if that's the right word, in the occupation of Veracruz. It was eventually settled by arbitration. Huerta actually resigns. The United States withdrew its troops. It didn't lead to full-scale war. But I think it's suggestive of the kinds of activities the Navy and the Navy Marine Corps team were still carrying out in this kind of 19th century style of enforcing American interests on foreign stations abroad.
You know, it's interesting, when you're speaking of Veracruz, I'm in the middle of reading the book about the USS Neosho in the Battle of Coral Sea, the ship that would not die. And it talks about Admiral Fletcher, and he's one of the guys that got the Cracker Jack
Indeed had a Medal of Honor, and again, kind of with an asterisk afterward, he earned it, or he received it. I got to not say the word earn. You don't earn the Medal of Honor. It is awarded. But he received the Medal of Honor in that operation, and there were some who kind of discounted that, probably with some justification. You're right.
Yeah. The Great War, as a lot of people call World War One, it broke out in 1914, and we'll talk in a bit about, you know, how it impacted the when the U.S. finally joined it. But with the war breaking out in 1914, and as the U.S. Navy leaders were watching what was happening in Europe and in the Far East even, you know, how did that affect our naval planning as we prepared for our eventual entry?
Well, the initial and immediate and pretty consistent American reaction to the outbreak of war in Europe is, this has nothing to do with us. We want absolutely to stay out of this thing. We'll count on the Atlantic moat to keep us separated. That became difficult, and the difficulties emerged relatively soon, of course, with the German decision to implement U-boat warfare. On one level, the Americans saw this as inhumane. Guerre de course, that is, the attack on enemy commerce, had been a consistent American tactic in all of its wars, with Britain certainly, using privateers and small raiders to attack merchant shipping, but somehow using submerged vessels to attack from the depths, this struck us as somehow not quite cricket, just not done. And, of course, the sinking of the Lusitania in 1915 turned a lot of Americans against Germany. There's a public sensibility that somehow the Germans sunk the Lusitania and we went to war. That's not really the way it worked. The Lusitania was sunk in 1915. We don't go to war for two more years yet. But what it did was sensitize Americans to the heinous character of U-boat warfare, that it attacked civilians from the depths, unannounced, secretly, and so on. There was so much animosity in the United States after this, that after the sinking of the Sussex, a year later in 1916, the Germans pledged that they wouldn't do this anymore, that they would stop U-boat warfare. But when their backs were to the wall in 1917 with the collapse of Russia and their exit from the war, the confrontations on the Western Front became so ferocious that the Germans thought, we have to end this thing soon before we run out of resources, and they reinstituted unrestricted U-boat warfare, and that was what got the United States Congress to declare war. Wilson, of course, goes before Congress and says, you know, we must do this for the greater good of mankind or whatever. But even before that moment comes, I think probably the most important sort of pre-1917 event in the United States is the passage of the Naval Act of 1916. This is passed not to get ready to go to war. It's passed in anticipation of one or the other side's winning in Europe so that we can protect ourselves from a potential invasion of the Western Hemisphere. So the Naval Act of 1916 is a defensive act to create a big navy that can defend our own coast from a European invasion. But it's the largest naval appropriation in the history of the United States up to that time. It's enormous. It's really an entire fleet. It authorizes 10 battleships and 6 battlecruisers, so that's really 16 capital ships to go with the almost 16 that we've already built since the USS Michigan, 10 cruisers, 50 destroyers, 75 other ships, an enormous fleet. And it's still under construction, of course, when the United States declares war in 1917.
You know, when the U.S. finally threw its hat in 1917, and it's always my paternal grandfather deployed with the Arkansas BB-33 when they went up to join the 6th Battle Squadron of the Grand Fleet. Nice parade, but they really didn't do much with the capital ships. But there was a significant U.S. contribution in the World War I version of the Battle of the North Atlantic. You touched on a bit about the unrestricted U-boat warfare. What were some of the other things that all of our planning and thoughts maybe didn't quite flesh out the way we thought, and some adjustments we had to make based upon the reality at sea that we found?
Yeah, I mentioned the Naval Act of 1916, and it focused on battleships. I mentioned the 10 battleships and 6 battlecruisers. What that reflects is the American notion, and really I would say the global notion, that battleships are the measure of a nation's military capability at sea. What we discovered when we got into the war is the British really don't need any more battleships, thank you very much. They had fought this tactically drawn battle of Jutland in 1916, and from that moment on, the battleships never confronted one another in World War I. That isn't where the action was. Now, we did send a squadron, about a division, the battleship, 6 of the old coal-burning, the pre-dreadnoughts, our older battleships, over to Britain, but mostly as a gesture of solidarity. They anchored in Scapa Flow and pretty much stayed there for the duration of the war. And the reason we sent coal burners is because oil was getting pretty scarce. They didn't want to waste it on these ships that everybody kind of figured were going to pretty much loiter in port most of the time. So the battleships, American battleships, do not play a role in World War I, in spite of having built so many of them and invested so much money in them. What does matter, as you point out, is this war against the U-boats. And to defeat the U-boats, what's necessary are convoys. Now, it took the West, and by the West I mean the Anglo-American allies, it took them a long time to come around to this notion. They thought, well, convoys, that can't be any good. I mean, all the ships are clustered together, making a nice, big, target-rich environment, and everybody has to proceed at the speed of the slowest ship. Why is that a good idea? Nevertheless, convoys proved, in practice, to be the single most important weapon to defeat the U-boat. Convoys escorted by small ships, destroyers, destroyer escorts, as they came to be called later, and small vessels that could compete against the U-boats in this sort of Battle of the Atlantic. Battle of the Atlantic, actually a term that applies more to World War II than to World War I, but many of the same tactics are involved. And I want to mention in particular in that regard, we're talking about the warrior writers that are the display that's being carried on in the museum right now. And certainly someone that falls into that category is William S. Sims, S-I-M-S, William S. Sims, a captain, rear admiral soon after, who is sent to Britain by Wilson as a kind of advance guard, if you would, to talk with the British about what do you need, how's it going, what can we do. And that's when Sims learns, and through him the Americans learn, how desperate this war against the U-boats has become. And Sims is one of the principal players in convincing the British to embrace convoys as an anti-U-boat weapon. And, of course, it works, and the goods get through, and eventually the Germans wear down, and the war comes to an end in 1918.
And so that brings the boldface items of the 19-teens to a close. And I look forward to our next episode in Time Together, Greg, when we start to touch into some of the great innovations we see in the 1920s in the interwar period.
All right, Sal. Sounds good.
Claude, in the last episode, we kicked off the first decade of the 1900s and that afterglow from the Spanish-American War. And when you look at the period of time, you know, roughly a decade and a half from the end of the Spanish-American War to in 1914 when World War I kicked off, though we didn't join it for a few more years, you really saw with in the U.S. and globally as well, not only did the technology advance so much, but an interest and understanding and an appreciation of the importance of sea power increase. And we saw a quickening in the conversation, and even back over 100 years ago with the printing press technology they had, we also had a greater velocity of thought where people's ideas on different sides of issues are being brought out. People are engaging in a conversation really on a global manner. And we even saw that in the U.S. Naval Institute's proceedings and how they published. What was the change that we saw in the early 1900s through the World War I era on how proceedings joined that conversation?
Well, first, proceedings had to respond very rapidly in the wake of the Spanish-American War and the Russo-Japanese, the comparatively short Russo-Japanese War, both very decisive conflicts among major powers. It forced the United States officer corps to think differently, as I mentioned in a previous episode, not only about its own role, but its own role in the world, and now among this the great powers of Europe who had these massive fleets. Proceedings followed very quickly because they had been a quarterly journal since the 1870s, so for that held for 40 years. Now in 1914, they moved from a quarterly to a bi-monthly. And then in 1917, just 3 years later, they become a monthly in order to accommodate the number of submissions they're receiving, in order to accommodate, as you pointed out, this velocity of thought, and to ensure that the timeliness of the articles was available to general readers. The general thinking among the junior officers during this time, you have folks like Lieutenant Lynn Cotton, who has his honorable mention prize essay of 1910 on the naval strategy of the Russo-Japanese War. So that still became, that was still a very popular topic. Marine Lieutenant William Hoadley also wrote about it, but from a different perspective. He translated literally hundreds of pieces of Japan's official war record. So there was a great deal of information that they were sifting through. And it, of course, in the aftermath of any war, it takes time to sift through this data, particularly not only with translations, but really as you move away from the conflict, you get a better sense. It's sort of like our museum at the Naval Academy. We really can't just yet provide panels and exhibits on the war in Afghanistan and the war in Iraq. It's still fresh in the public psyche, and you really have to remove yourself a few decades before you can have a proper sense of what it meant, of what the results were. There are sometimes no short answers and quick answers. So I think in that regard, it took a decade just for the Russo-Japanese War impact to be reflected in proceedings. The second issue you have is this advance of technology, and particularly with regard to platforms. You have, for centuries and centuries, you had surface ships that were the predominant platform. And although here and there in the 19th century you had submersibles and eventually submarines at the turn of the century, this is the first decade where we start to see submarines being used in actual widespread warfare. So you have individuals like a Lieutenant Chester Nimitz, who writes an article in the 1910s about the military value and tactics of modern submarines. So this, we're now looking at three-dimensional naval warfare, not only with the submarines but with aircraft. And you have exhibit cases for the Warrior Writer exhibit, we have the diary of Admiral Bradley Fisk, and among his many accomplishments, he wrote about the idea of lightweight torpedoes that could be carried by aircraft. So you have this massive sense of urgency, particularly once the war begins in 1914, which folks initially thought would be over very quickly, as they do with many wars, and it quickly becomes a stalemate. But you start to see the impact of submarines in the Atlantic especially, and eventually the integration of naval aviation toward the end of the war.
And with the World War, as it breaks out, obviously the U.S. Navy gets involved. But the U.S. Navy is not really a naval war from a U.S. perspective by the time we get our battleships in, we get some of our convoys going. Mm-hmm. From a museum and an exhibit point of view, do we have many items that are iconic of the American participation in the First World War?
I think there was always a concern, first of all, about mines. So we actually do have a mine that's available on display that was taken from the North Sea. We have the medals of Admiral William Benson, who was the first Chief of Naval Operations for most of the war. And those are the two major pieces, in addition to some models of ships. And we are now looking at some of the boat models and changing them out, the paint scheme, because what we decided is that dazzle camouflage becomes an important part of surface ships and their operations in both world wars. And, of course, dazzle camouflage could be changed depending on the type of seas, whether it was the Pacific or the Atlantic or the English Channel, or if you wanted to make a ship look longer or shorter. There's all sorts of fascinating schemes that the artists use in order to deceive the eyeball, if you will, of the especially of the U-boat commanders. And so I think those are particularly helpful. And we have a few items from folks like Edward Kalbfus, U.S. Naval Academy class of 1899. He eventually becomes president of the Naval War College. He's a two-term director of naval history. And here we start to see in the early 20th century that there is an appreciation for understanding our naval history and how that might be incorporated into Naval War College courses as well. And as we continue to see today in the as plebes at the Naval Academy all take Naval History HH-104 to get a better understanding and a survey course to better prepare them.
And you've already mentioned a couple of the items I think for our next episode we're going to be able to touch on. And when you look back at some of the older writings from this period, you can start to see the hints and ideas of the things to come, specifically submarines and aviation. And I look forward to hitting the 1920s to you, and we'll see what that decade can bring us.
Thank you.